atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Northern Kentucky University political scientist Michael Baranowski. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney, and reluctant ultra-crepidarian, Jay Garson.
Wow. Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, well,
I think with that, that's new.
That is my new word of the week. And for those of you who don't know, including me up until recently, ultra crepidarian means expressing opinions on matters outside the scope of one's knowledge or expertise. And so I thought it was safe to call you a reluctant ultra crepidarian, right?
Oh, I suppose reluctant. Yeah.
Yeah, reluctant ultra crepidarian. That's, you know, you're reluctant. The reason this came up is I was reading reports, and some of you might have heard this, about RFK Jr. thinking about VP picks for his ticket, and he mentioned possibly Aaron Rodgers, and I thought, wow, that would be someone going outside of his area of expertise and a little searching. I said, is there a word for that? Yes, there is, and it's ultra-crepidarian. And so there we go. Anyway.
Well, I only reluctantly,
exactly.
Again, when pushed,
That's. I thought it was perfect. So there we go. I don't know it's going to stick, but I just wanted to throw it out there. Anyway, before we get going with everything we want to talk about today, and there's a bunch, the government funding bill to avert a shutdown, the Apple lawsuit, some primary results from this week, a whole lot more. I want to mention that The Politics Guys is joining the Democracy Group, which is a network of podcasts that are focused on democracy, civic engagement, and civil discourse. I've known some of the people running the Democracy Group for years now. I've enjoyed a bunch of their shows, and so I'm really pleased that we're going to be coming on board at some point in the near future here. There's some onboarding things we have to do. And this won't change really anything we do here in The Politics Guys, because we're all about democracy, civic engagement, and civil discourse, So
we are.
There you go. But once we are fully on board, we'll be working with other podcasts in the group, very like-minded, and we'll be letting you know about, well, even more stuff we think that you will appreciate. And it also gives us an opportunity to sort of connect with new listeners, work with other podcasters who we believe share our values, and just kind of, spread the word about what we're doing and why we think it matters. So good stuff.
Special crossover events, Mike.
There we go. Special crossover events, all kinds of good stuff. I think it's going to be great. So, all right. One other thing, though, I should mention before we get going, just really quick, I want to thank Mike, Venmo, who supported us on Venmo. Yes, you can do that. Links in the show notes. And also Dane, who is our newest Patreon yearly supporter, save 10% over monthly. You can do that as well. Thank you guys so much. We really do appreciate it. All right. So here we go. Starting with the government funding bill. Now, the House of Representatives averted a partial government shutdown by passing a $1.2 trillion spending bill. The vote was 286 to 143. Nearly two-thirds of those votes came from Democrats. 101 Republicans voted for it, and 112 voted against it. Now, the right flank of the House Republican caucus was not happy. And in fact, there have been at least some calls, Marjorie Taylor Greene, to oust Speaker Johnson from his position. But oust him or not, clearly, Freedom Caucus people not happy. Thomas Massie said, "It's got a dangerous cocktail that the swamp has always served, and we're drunk on it today." What is that cocktail? Earmarks and budget gimmicks. There we go, Thomas Massie. Now, the Senate, after it got it from the House within 12 hours, approved the legislation, a late night 74 to 24 vote. This followed a bunch of amendments proposed by Republicans on things like a couple of more immigration. I think there was one on tailpipe emissions. All of those failed, and the measure ended up passing. Now, Republicans did get a number of things, though, that they should like here. For instance, money for 2,000 more Border Patrol agents, more immigration detention beds, a 25% increase for technology at the southern border. And it also rescinds $20.2 billion of the almost $80 billion that the IRS was given back in 2022 for additional funding. And all of those cuts are going to come from the agency's enforcement budget, though somehow the IRS says it will not affect their plans to conduct more audits of corporations and high-income households anyway. Now, they also rejected, I should point out, what's supposed to be an automatic increase in their salary, which is currently $174,000 a year. It's been at that level for the last 15 years. Now, Democrats did get some things that they wanted as well, even though overall, when we look at the pullback and look at the overall budget, it's pretty much in non-defense terms, essentially flat from last year. But Democrats got $1 billion more in new funding for Head Start. They also got $1 billion for what's called climate resilience in the Department of Defense. So there was a little bit there, but pretty clearly a compromise. Jay, what do you think about this budget, and also maybe talk a little bit about whether you think it might end up tanking Mike Johnson's precarious speakership?
So overall, I'm of the opinion that sort of it is a mixed bag, right? I think politically, and Marjorie Taylor Greene will disagree with me, government shutdowns do not work, do not benefit Republicans ever. I'll repeat that. Republicans always lose government shutdowns. If there's any question about that, Republicans always lose government shutdowns. So I think avoiding the shutdown was smart politics. I think the bill itself was okay. It was not as good as it might have been. I think if Republicans had stuck together, I think they probably could have gotten better deals on things like defense, for example, on the border, for example. But the thing is that the numbers are what they are, right? And when you have that narrow of a margin, you're not going to get everything you want. And I think it was someone summed it up that, you know, the great sin of the speaker right now is, well, he can do math. And, you know, there it is. Look, in a perfect world, would I have liked a budget that cut spending, increased, you know, overall, but increased military spending? Yes. You know, funded border security up to and including walls? Absolutely. But those numbers aren't there. And you have to sort of deal with the situation that's in front of you and make the best of it that you can, move on, live to fight another day. And I think that's more or less what they did. So I think there are some egregious, you know, pork projects, wasteful spending, but, you know, same as it ever was, right? And those are all good things that we can campaign against next year. So this year. But yes, that's my two on the Marjorie Taylor Greene. Again, it just borders into the ridiculous. And quite honestly, look, she'd do this regardless, right? Whatever was in the bill, because it's not particularly about the bill or ideology. It's about Marjorie Taylor Greene. It's about, you know, calling everybody else a sellout. I'm hopeful eventually the Republican Party gets tired of this sort of nonsense, right? Of the,
With the math being what it is, and Mike Gallagher just recently announced his early retirement, and what that means even going forward is Republicans
down to one.
Yeah, exactly. So you can only afford to lose one vote on party line votes, and that just gives those folks, those crazies on your right flank, a whole lot of power. There used to be a thing, Jay, you remember back in the day, called the Hastert Rule. And for those of you who don't know, the Hastert Rule was sort of an informal norm, if you will, of the House, saying that the Speaker would not bring anything up for a vote unless a majority of the Speaker's party was in support of it, basically. And right. as
it's also could be referred to as common sense.
Yeah, well, but at this point,
or basic math.
Yeah, but as Hakeem Jeffries pointed out, said, well, once again, Democrats race to the rescue, bail out the House Republicans and fund the government, essentially, because Republicans can't stick together and get their act together. And there's a lot of truth in that.
Well, look, the idea is when you have bigger numbers, you can afford to have people take a walk. That's what we always used to call it in the Ohio House. And it all worked out, right? You guarantee that you had your majority, that what you needed. And look, if somebody else has to take a walk because of their district, because of something else they've got going on, then fine. But when the numbers are that close, you just can't do that. And yeah, I think it's a bizarre sort of world we've gotten into a little bit, where this screaming over, you know, ideological purity, which again, on issues that aren't particularly ideological,
I should point out just to say, you know, in just over 6 months, we're going to go through this whole thing again.
Yeah.
Because this budget year, which was just only now fully funded, ends on September 30th. And I can only imagine in the face of an election, just, you know, more than a month after that deadline, only a month after that deadline, basically 5 weeks. I certainly don't predict a smooth process. I mean, when Mike Johnson came in, he said, you know, we're going to have votes on each of these individual bills. I'm not going
to return to regular order and all that.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's clearly not something that's going to happen, because there just aren't enough people in Mike Johnson's caucus who want to do that. Now, a speaker could potentially do that, but he would have to work so much with Democrats and give so much to Democrats to make that happen that person would not end up being speaker. And so, again, coming back to where you started, it's all about the math, and the math keeps on getting tougher for House Republicans. And now with the loony right flank having even more, I shouldn't call them loony. They're just very self-interested. Marjorie Taylor Greene, I don't think is dumb or loony. She just doesn't care a whit about governing. She just cares about self-promotion and so forth. And so, but that just gives the Marjorie Taylor Greens even more power. And so I don't see this next budget being any easier than this, and certainly not a return to the regular order for budgetary matters.
Yeah. One thing we should mention is this was an actual budget as opposed to just another CR.
Yeah.
That's continuing resolution. Cool kids call it the CR. We could see that in September.
Oh, we will see that. We're not going to get a budget.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no way.
Because nobody's going to want to. Yeah. Yeah.
And especially, I think it's even more likely we're going to get that, because a lot of Republicans are going to be thinking, well, hey, there's a good chance that our guy's going to be in the White House. And so if we can just kind of CR this out until late January, we're going to be in a lot better position.
Well, yeah, just taking a vote on something new right before the election, that's just not good for anybody.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, my other thought, and again, this goes to sort of the right wing on these sort of things. And it's weird, Mike, because I used to kind of think that, hey, I'm the right wing. But there's something, it's what it reminds me of. It's like yahoos on sports radio, right? Who are sort of, you know, call in on Monday morning and, you know, we should go for it on fourth down on every, you know, every time. And, you know, why are we, it just these dumb sort of impossibilities, right? You know, we should have, you know, gone for it on fourth and 15, as opposed to kicking the 20-yard field goal. It like that kind of stuff, right? That you hear all the time. And it's more just this, and I believe this, and I'm right because I'm a real fan. And you can be a real fan, but still understand the contours of the game, right? And what's possible and what's not possible. And I think that's what troubles me about this, is that, you know, this sort of, oh, we could have got, should have got all this stuff. Well, no, you just weren't going to, right? You know, geez, if we'd only put this guy in, you know, we would have won by three touchdowns. No, it's a sort of a variety of almost of magical thinking, right? And I think it's a problem, because what happens is you sacrifice a lot of what you could actually get, right? If you play the game right, so you might end up winning by a field goal, and the people who wanted to win by three touchdowns will be disappointed. But it's still a win. And otherwise, I think lots of times you just don't get the win.
Well, sure. But I don't see this dynamic changing anytime soon. I mean, the only way it's going to change is if there's a large enough majority from one party or the other to, well, one part or the other to be able to ignore those crazies that you need in a close margin. And of course, point out that, you know, the left, we have our own people who are kind of out of the mainstream and push for stuff. But on the left, we've been able to, you know, certainly when we had control of the House, we were able to work with those people. I would argue that our folks are more reasonable on the extremes than your folks are when it comes down to brass tacks.
Oh, I'd view it a little differently. This would be my second biggest rule after Republicans always lose government shutdowns, is Democrats, and the one sort of follows from the other. Democrats, I think historically and always and in real life, have much better party discipline than Republicans ever have or ever will have.
I don't know about that, but I will certainly say, at least in the short term, that has seemed to have been the case, certainly, at least since the rise of the post-Tea Party, post-Trump, certainly post-Trump party in that. So at least legislatively.
I would say Democrats tend to be much more willing to suck it up and take one for the team.
That's a lot of
than what Republicans would. And maybe it's you know, that Republicans are more of these, you know, rugged individuals or something like that. I think it's more power, party control, just internally, right? I think that's just the way it works and has happened. And I've seen that very much on the local level, state level, and I think it exists at the national level as well.
Well, I guess it all comes from the head down, right? And certainly Donald Trump is not one known for taking one for the team. Going with the program, that sort of thing, and the influences all the way down. But anyway, so we will be talking not about this legislation, but we'll be coming back to this at some point within the next 6 months, and it'll probably be a whole lot more of the same, but we shall see. All right, moving on to something a little bit different. Late this week, the Department of Justice and 15 states, as well as the District of Columbia, sued Apple, alleging antitrust violations. Now, the suit claims that Apple has reduced competition in the smartphone market by, in the words of the lawsuit, delaying, degrading, or outright blocking technologies that would increase competition in smartphone markets by decreasing barriers to switching to another smartphone, among other things. More specifically, the government alleges anti-competitive behavior in five areas. Limiting access to so-called super apps that allow for multiple services in a single app, text messaging, cloud-based games, smartwatch interoperability, and digital wallets. Now, the government's claiming that Apple wraps itself in a cloak of privacy, security, and consumer preferences to justify its anti-competitive conduct, spending billions on marketing and branding to promote the self-serving premise that only Apple can safeguard consumers' privacy and security interests. Only they can do it. That sounds familiar. Anyway, in a news conference on Thursday announcing the lawsuit, Attorney General Merrick Garland said, over the last two decades, Apple has become one of the most valuable public companies in the world, in large part due to the success of the iPhone. And their share of the performance smartphone market, according to Garland, exceeds 70%, and of the entire smartphone market, over 65% in the U.S. Garland continued, Apple has maintained monopoly power in the smartphone market, not simply by staying ahead of the competition on the merits, but by violating federal antitrust law. Now, in response, a spokesperson for Apple said, this lawsuit threatens who we are and the principles that set Apple products apart in the fiercely competitive markets. If successful, it would hinder our ability to create the kind of technology people expect from Apple, where hardware, software, and services intersect. The company also argued that the lawsuit sets a dangerous precedent, empowering government to take a heavy hand in designing people's technology. And for those of you who are wondering, the states joining this lawsuit, actually a mix of liberal and conservative states. You got Arizona, California, Connecticut, Maine, Michigan, Minnesota, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, North Dakota, Oklahoma, Oregon, Tennessee, Vermont, and Wisconsin. So, Jay, what's your take on this latest of a number of big tech lawsuits we've seen in recent years?
So I would say underwhelmed by the government's allegations. If you look at, you know, one of the tests, right? Does this benefit the consumer? And I think Apple's going to be able to show a lot of evidence that their processes, their closed environment, right? That's essentially what we're talking about, has benefited consumers. And it's not that there's some sort of lack of companies creating apps right? That are offered on through Apple. There's no real boost in prices of these apps. In fact, there's a lot of competition there. So I'm just not seeing it. It looks all the world to me like, you know, the Clinton era Microsoft case, which again was they committed the sin of having a, you know, browser come with their package. So I'm not a fan of this. I think government's antitrust efforts could be much better directed somewhere else. And I do think it will hamper technology. I think Apple has, in many terms, built a better mousetrap. And if you look, I know there are people who are Apple lovers and Apple haters, and I'm sort of in the middle, right? I mean, I've got an iPhone and I really like it. I don't think I would change it to anything else. Not because I'm necessarily trapped by the company or something like that, but just because I like it. But either way, it's not as if there aren't other options are out there. It's not as if they are unfairly controlling, you know, the ability to market or to compete either in the app space or the phone space. So,
yeah, I think that's a little bit of a straw man. I'm not saying that I disagree with you in the end, but I think, my take is that, of course, Apple's engaged in as much anti-competitive behavior as they can. But that doesn't mean the government has
Yeah, it's one thing to say anti-competitive behavior, and maybe I should have qualified illegal anti-competitive behavior.
Yeah, okay. Well,
Or I guess maybe what you, if you want to say, look, you want to do the best you can to compete and you know, lock out the other guy, that's competitive behavior.
Well, yes and no. Here's the thing is it gets kind of complex because under the law, there are certain things, for instance, certain actions that a company that is not a monopolist can take that a company that is a monopolist can't necessarily take. And it gets kind of, so there are a bunch of moving parts here. For instance, one issue that I haven't seen really focused on as much as I'd like to see is, well, is Apple actually a monopoly? Part of Apple's defense is going to be, well, no, they're going to define the market as broadly as possible and say that, no, you can't define the market as just performance smartphones, as Garland and the government did, but it's not just all smartphones too, but anything that has smartphone-like functions, which could be anything from like, I don't know, an e-reader to a bunch of other things. And so that I think is a reasonable point to make, but I should also point out that, well, whether or not a company is a monopoly for the purposes of the Sherman Act, that's not defined in the legislation. It depends on a lot of factors. Market share is one of that, but it's something called significant and durable market power, which basically means
can it exercise monopoly power?
Exactly. And so that's a little harder to necessarily determine. Now, that generally comes along with having a strong majority of the market. And so again, there's a lot of nuance in here. And not only that, but I would argue that based on my reading of the law and my thinking about this is that there are certain things that, for instance, if Apple just makes insanely great products, and that's why they're making some of these business decisions, literally just for the security and safety of the people who buy their products, there's not necessarily anything that's a legal violation there. But if they do those exact same things with the intent to squelch competition, intent actually matters under the law. Now, that can be difficult to prove. And there were some kind of anecdotal, some emails and other things kind of sprinkled in that lawsuit. Now, I don't think that there's enough there to demonstrate that. I think Apple can make a strong enough case that their closed, walled-in garden sort of thing does provide that was the primary intent of that. So I'm frustrated here, Jay, because number one, I hate Apple and all it stands for. That kind of smug, paternalistic, oh, we'll give you shiny things and just do things our way. And it's just, it rubs me the wrong way. It's some deep part of myself. But I also know they make really good products and they work really well together as long as you want to do what they want you to do. It's very much kind of like a Huxley and sort of Brave New World sort of thing that makes me just want to vomit. But I get it. And so it's frustrating to me because I hate the company just in general, but I don't really think the government has a strong enough case here to demonstrate that what they're doing is actually a violation of the law. So that's where I'm at.
Well, it's good. It's good that, yeah, it's good that you base the one's legal culpability on what they actually did rather than just how you feel about it.
And that's not necessarily, no, I will say there are things here. Do you think that government, at least pressure and the threat of a lawsuit, is important? Like there are some instances where you can argue that Apple has engaged in anti-competitive behavior and has changed their practices in the face of pressure that would not have necessarily resulted in a change. Like, for instance, text messaging. There's Jay, whenever I send you a text message, you get a green bubble. And that means, you know, some sad, poor person who doesn't have an iPhone is sending you a message, right? But also there's not that encryption there that you get in Apple's little closed system. Right. Now they were able,
I typically ignore them anyway.
Well, there you go. So, you know. But the point is they actually were able to make a change. They can make a change to give that same similar level of security to non-Apple messages. And they're in fact going to implement that in the near future. And that is something they wouldn't have necessarily done. I don't think they would have done it all absent some pressure. And there's some other changes like that they've made. But I agree that this idea that they have to design their systems so that they're as open as possible. No, that's a business decision. You know, Google, Android have decided to go with a more open model. That's their business decision. And that's, you know, certainly opens a lot, raises a lot.
So Apple should be punished because their business decision seems to have turned out to have been a better one.
Well, no, and I wouldn't even necessarily say that. If you look at worldwide share, that maybe is not actually a better decision. American market maybe is a different thing. And so it's not better or worse. It's just a question of, is what you are doing for the purpose of helping consumers, or are you engaged in behavior that ends up hurting consumers and hurting the market?
Yeah, and the other big test, right, of whether it hurts consumers and also of monopoly power is, can you dictate prices? And that certainly hasn't seemed to have been an issue. I don't see it.
Well, I think
evidence for that there.
I think there is.
I mean, iPhones are more expensive, but
I think there's evidence. Yeah, the evidence for that. If you create a walled environment, making it very difficult to switch, and you charge a premium for the products within that environment, people often say, well, you know, here I am with Apple, and someone said, well, you could save a lot of money. Yeah, but you know, I got this thing that works with this thing and so forth. And so is that dictating prices? Well, then there's the question of App Store prices and the cut they take, and the question of, well, you know, they offer certain through their e-wallet system. Well, that's not as open as it possibly could be. Does that mean they dictate prices, how the cut they get? I mean, I'm saying that it's not as cut and dried as a lot of the Apple fan people might suggest it is, but also that doesn't mean that the government has a strong case, because I don't think the government does have a strong case here.
Yeah, I think we can agree on that.
Yeah, and I would expect.
Again, I'm Apple. I'm sort of Apple neutral, right? I mean, I look, I get where you're coming from, and there is the sort of the smugness and the, if you know, I would never be someone who would, you know, line up and, you know, wait for hours to get a new, you know, product or something like that. And I've got my iPhone is like, I think an iPhone 8. So wow. It is like well behind the curve, but I like it. And I, you know, seen Android stuff and I like Apple better. So I, like I said, I'm sort of a, you know, neutral pro. I'm certainly not an Apple cultist, I guess.
But I
appreciate innovation, right?
Yeah. I wonder what you think about my perspective on this, that even if you don't necessarily have the strongest case, this idea of bringing pressure to bear in some, it's like, for instance, Apple for the longest time has been a huge opponent of right to repair laws, right? They designed their thing so that anti-tinkering, which is another thing that drives me nuts. I'm a big, I like to take things apart and tinker with them. And Apple products are not designed that way. But after a whole lot of pressure for a bunch of years in a bunch of states and lawsuits and other things, they've sort of changed their position. It's a standard corporate thing where say, listen, we'll get behind this, and it's more than what we'd like, but less than what would be mandated through regulation in some way. And so I feel like it's like a partial win, which is why I think having this pressure from government, because someone's got to keep the multi-trillion dollar company honest. And if the government isn't in there keeping an eye on them, God knows what stuff they're going to be up to.
Wow. I'm not. If it's government pressure to do something which the government would be allowed to do, I don't think I particularly have a problem. Although it concerns me when government pressure becomes something else, right? And I would say we didn't talk about this because I think we were off last week. But for example, the Supreme Court case in Murthy versus Missouri. That gives me pause. Now, again, this is completely different. We're talking antitrust type stuff or technical stuff or FTC type stuff. But yeah, I'm not crazy about that sort of government heavy handedness, right? Of the, hey, we really think you should provide your security to your competitors for free for text messaging. How come? Well, you know, we invested a lot to do that security to make it special for our customers. We're entitled to return on our investment on that. Yeah. But these guys should get security too. So we think you should provide it for free.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I'm not crazy about that either. Cause I think Apple's that part of their response saying that, do we really want government or government regulators deciding how technology works in certain aspects, how much interoperability there has to be, and how easy? One person gave an example of, said, well, I can't use, one podcast I was listening to said, I can't use the AirPods because of whatever, they're just not comfortable, but they sync so much better with my iPhone than these other ones I use. And so is that an antitrust issue?
That's just a trade-off. Yeah.
But it could be. It could be if Apple said, listen, let's put some code in here that makes it more difficult. You see what I'm saying? Intent matters. Yeah, but of course,
they didn't.
Well, we don't know that they did. The government can't prove that they did. That's the point. Because, of course, even Apple, as a presumption of innocence, right? Even multi-trillion dollar companies are presumed innocent until proven guilty. And that's how it should be.
So let's talk about that. You mentioned the AirPod example. I have, as you know, Mike, I'm very outdoorsy, very athletic. Running. I have JPL earbuds, which work fine for me. I think they're great. They don't fall out when I run, and they're probably half the price of AirPods. And to me, I looked at that. Here are my choices, and I got those. So, you know, if you're throwing that, I'm not saying it's fair to say that you just kind of, you know, threw that off as a potential example. But if I switched phones, could I still use these same earbuds? Yeah. So they're certainly not controlling anything there. And again, my issue with this also is the incentives, right? If you do this, like you said, the pressure of, look, we really should do this. You should open up this more. You should. That all comes at a cost. And at some point, the company's going to say, well, look, we want to spend more money on innovation if the government's going to make us give it away for free.
Absolutely. And there's not a lot of distance between us on that. What I'm saying is that if it gets to the point where Apple's management is saying to the engineering team, listen, we understand that these JBL earbuds work really well, but we would rather they not work so well, so design something in the phone that makes them work less well.
Right.
That would be a potential antitrust problem. That would be anti-competitive behavior. But again, I wouldn't be surprised if some of that's going on, but I don't think the government can demonstrate any of that, which is why in the end, I don't think this is going to go anywhere, though we won't know for a few years. Okay, well, let's move on to something in more your backyard than mine, even though we're both Ohioans, but we are going to be talking about a guy with sort of a Cleveland connection. So go ahead.
Yeah, so, I'll get to that in a minute. So last week, Ohio held its Republican senatorial primary. Former car dealer Bernie Marino, if you're from Ohio, Bernie Marino, won by 50.5%. Second place going to Matt Dolan, 32.7%, and a distant third to Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose. Dolan is an attorney, still Ohio State Senator, but member of the Dolan family that owns the Cleveland Guardians, formerly known as the Cleveland Indians. So, you know, kind of big money there. Marino had a lot of money. It was sort of a really vicious primary, and Trump backed Marino early. And it's funny, again, living in Ohio, but then also reading all the national media on this I guess I understand it. For national media, they lead with the Trump-backed candidate, you know, Bernie Marino wins Ohio primary. And no doubt he did, and no doubt he was backed by Trump. I'm reading I think the Trump endorsement is important. I don't think it is critical, right? And I think the fact that it was a three-person race also changed things, because if you take out LaRose, I think the anti-Marino vote, split between Dolan and LaRose. I don't think LaRose took anything away from Marino. I think it all came from Dolan, or vice versa, depending on how you look at that. Yeah, everyone is saying this is some sort of bellwether and Trump power. And I think there's something to that, but I don't think it's quite what's being built up. And I can explain all my whys and wherefores in a minute, but I'll let you comment first, Mike.
Yeah, I'd say we'll try not to get too deep into the Ohio-specific weeds, but there, of course, were also primary elections in, I believe, five other states. We focus on Ohio, not because we know the most about Ohio, which we do, of course, particularly Jay, but because that was the election really where there was more of a thing that actually had some sort of national implications, as you mentioned, because not only was Bernie Marino supported early by Donald Trump, but Matt Dolan was sort of the Republican old guard establishment choice. Former Senator Rob Portman supported him. Governor DeWine supported him. And from a Democrat standpoint, from my standpoint, this was actually the outcome that I would have hoped for, because.
Yeah. And in fact, Democrats spent money to elect the bomb thrower threat to democracy, Bernie Marino.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, this gives Sherrod Brown, who's running for re-election against now Bernie Marino, I think a bit more of a chance. Now, he ran in 2018. He won by just over 6 points, also running against someone who was endorsed by Donald Trump. So, but Ohio trending much more red. I think it's going to be, you know, a pretty close race. Brown's, a strong candidate, certainly understands the state. But this is super important for Democrats, because with West Virginia already basically in the Republican win column, if the Democrats don't hold in Ohio, well, they have to hold in Ohio, Arizona, Montana, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Nevada to end up with just 50 seats. And that's a pretty tall order, which is why Ohio, this is so important. And this was the best possible outcome from this Republican primary for Democrats, who are hoping against hope, I think, to maintain some slim control over the Senate. Well, one other thing I wanted to talk about in regards to this is something that made a lot of national news earlier on. And that was, you mentioned Donald Trump was a main early supporter of Marino. And there was this rally a lot of folks have heard about right at this point, where he said some particularly inflammatory things. And the one that got, I think, the most press probably, well, I don't know, a couple. One was that when he said about migrants, that young people, they're in jail for years. If you call them people, I don't know if you call them people. In some cases, they're not people, in my opinion, but I'm not allowed to say that because the radical left says that's a terrible thing to say. I want to start by taking that comment. Now, yeah, the radical left says it's a terrible thing to say that people aren't people, to say that people are animals, because it is a terrible thing to say. Depersonalizing people is an awful thing to do. And you don't have to be radical left to say that. But if you're part of some Trump crowd that is ostensibly, right, I guess, Christian, that is about the least unchristian in attitudes towards people as anyone I can imagine, yeah, you shouldn't say that people are not people. And so shame on Donald Trump for saying that. I think it's an awful thing to say. I'm not radical left, but that's horrible to say that people are not people or animals. And I want, what do you think, Jade? Would you say, in your opinion, that people crossing the border are not in fact people?
No, I wouldn't say that.
So they're human? Animals. That's what he's not implying. I'm saying. But what's your reaction to a candidate who says that, and not only says that, but people cheer that? I mean, it turns my stomach.
Well, I think let's look at a couple of things. And when we're talking about other Trump quotes, it may get into that kind of thing. Trump knows what he's doing, right? He's saying these inflammatory things, but he said, look, some of these people who were in jail, and I think it's fair. Well, maybe it's not fair, but would it be understandable to call people who are in prison for murder, rape, that sort of thing? Would you say they're animals? Well, maybe it's not polite, nice, perhaps not Christian. But there's a difference between saying these people who have been convicted of crimes and are behind bars for heinous crimes are animals. I wouldn't treat them as people, yada, yada, yada. I still wouldn't condone those comments. But if you look at it through that lens, if that's what he's saying.
And I think fair.
It's less inflammatory as opposed to saying all migrants are animals.
But let's also put that into context. And I think the context is important. And that's why I actually didn't just pull some comments out of context, but looked at the entire context of that speech. And in that context, it's pretty clear he's painting a picture of not just a few bad apples, if you will, but that literally he's saying they are emptying the prisons. They're sending. So the picture that he is painting is that the vast majority of these people invading, that's the word that the right likes to use, invading this country, they are the worst of the worst. They are just the horribles, this horde of animals just surging over the border. And oh my God, they're subhuman. They're not even people. That's the picture. And that is absolutely disgusting because it's untrue. And it's just disgusting and untrue. So there we go.
All right.
I mean, you don't disagree with that, do you? Or maybe.
No, I don't disagree.
And what but do you I'll, say I'll about a out. Guy who, a guy who, I mean, presumably he knows this to be untrue or a mischaracterization, a dehumanizing mischaracterization, because the vast majority of people who are crossing the border are not animals in that sense, right? So,
but you wouldn't disagree that there are certainly records of people we have now captured here who had significant criminal records before,
absolutely,
in their home countries and were released. There are a whole lot of Chinese nationals all of a sudden who, curiously, are crossing our border. That I think there's some reason for concern there. But that said, I think the bigger point is, right, we were talking about the Ohio Senate race, and we just diverted, and you spent, I don't know how many minutes, 5 minutes, talking about who?
Well, because it's always about Donald Trump. If you listen to his speech, I mean, that's why I think you're over focusing on the local things. And I get that because that's sort of but this is all about Trump. This is about a party. I mean, you take Bernie Marino, a guy who for all intents and purposes, if you would ask anyone about Bernie Marino,
who is a migrant who came across the border, albeit legally.
Bernie Marino, a guy who actually had said some pretty anti-Trump things about this loon taking over the party in like 2015, 2016. It's just another example of some shifty car salesman who will bend the knee to Donald Trump because he cares a whole lot more about power than he cares about integrity. And this is your party that's bending the knee, that's kissing the ring because in the end, integrity doesn't matter as much as power.
Well, Mike, you can say, yeah, it's my party, I suppose.
It is. Right?
It's not my party in that I exercise any control over it other than showing up. Right. I mean, look, there were Bernie Marino won by 50.5%. That's not a stunning margin. There were almost 50% of the people who voted against him.
But it was 17.6 more than, or 17 point something more than this. And so we don't know. You may be right that a lot of that LaRose vote might have gone to Dolan. Well, yeah. Okay. Yeah. You are right. There you go. Okay. We'll just stop at that. But my point being is even the polling suggested that the race was going to be a lot closer than that. And this surprised a lot of the, and that's, we've seen this with Donald Trump type stuff in the past. And so the reason I bring it back to Donald Trump is because this is Donald Trump's party. To the extent that we have not seen in a long, long time, this, the cult of personality that the Republican Party has become more and more is just something that is.
Oh, no, I agree with you there. I would, and very much that this whole cult of personality thing is antithetical to what I think the Republican Party should be about. Yeah, it goes against the, you know, core Whiggishness, right, that I like to mention. Of course, that's not a word that probably most party members or goers or, you know, and again, it's a little weird and academic and historical, but I think there was always something there. And I think there was always something of, not so long ago, 8-12 years ago, Republicans quite rightly took shots at Chris Matthews, right? Of the whole, like, you know, felt tingles up my leg when Barack Obama spoke. That it seems something that is terribly, terribly un-Republican, and I mean that in the small r letters, un-Republican to be so infatuated with one individual, right? Sort of the whole basis of Republicanism.
Well, at least Republicanism as it used to exist, because, of course, parties evolve over time for better or for worse. And that's a value neutral.
No, and I'm saying small r, right? You know what I mean?
So you really mean you're making a distinction here between conservative values that are often associated with the Republican Party. And I think it's important to make that distinction.
I think that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Because conservative values would not believe in massive government action to do pretty much of anything aside from defense, right. Basically.
Exactly.
These are no longer Republican values, or at least.
To me, such a core piece of, and again, it's coming, March 23rd today, not long after, you know, everyone always notes that March 15th, the Ides of March, you know, in some circles, it is, you know, this is an unlucky day, right? But in sort of, again, small r Republican philosophical circles, right? That the idea that the Senate preserves its prerogative and stops a dictator, right? That's a very sort of, again, Cato type idea. So,
we are against dictators.
That's what I mean by small r.
Yeah, we're both against dictators, even on day one, or even just for one day, certainly. And
so much of what the Republican Party grew out of was the Whig Party, which grew up out of opposition to Andrew Jackson and his sort of cult of personality. And the Whigs in England were the ones who opposed sort of the king and monarchical privilege and so forth. So it's the idea that, at least to my extent, and again, I think traditional conservative values are you don't elevate a single person over the ideas. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this, and this kind of ties into something that one of our listeners and supporters brought up on the Discord this week, Daniel. Because it seems to me that so much of not just stylistically and temperamentally, but in terms of beliefs and in terms of the overall relationship of the party in the electorate to him, that so much is anti-Trump for you, just almost as a natural sort of thing. And yet, so what Daniel asked, he said, you know, you've said, Jay, you've said that January 6th was an awful thing, but you also made it pretty clear that, or you implied, at least according to him, that a second Biden term would be worse than a second Trump term. And so Daniel's kind of wondering, well, is that because you believe nothing like January 6th will happen again from a Trump second term or worse? Or even if it did, if a Biden presidency would still be worse? Because I hear this tension in you, and I think a lot of listeners might hear this, because a lot of listeners have said, okay, Jay seems to be, oh, Donald Trump is this delusional, awful guy and so forth, and Republicans shouldn't be this way. But, and they say, what's the but? Geez, just vote for Biden or stay home, man. I think it's a reasonable thing to raise. Yeah.
So, well, first of all, I'll again comment on how deeply weird I think it is that this many people, and maybe it's only two or three, care about what I think or you know.
Well, I'll say it's not what you think.
Why won't Jay admit this?
I think that a lot of people understand that you are in a position that a lot of sort of establishment, if you will, Republicans are. And so it's not, I don't think they care so much about you personally. Maybe they do, but that there are a lot of Republicans who are kind of similarly situated, who I think a lot of us on the left feel like, why don't you help us out a little bit here? We both agree that this guy is awful. You're not running around with the MAGA hat and you think this is good for the country. So don't vote for him. Come on. We're not, yeah. You know, and so I think that's why people are trying to understand your thinking on this.
So the thinking, I guess, and again, keep in mind, Mike, and I've said this a lot of times. I mean, my tendency is not to get on and just necessarily bloviate about here's what I think. I'm trying to say, here's what I think is going on. Here's what conservatives are thinking. I throw in the here's what I think as part of that. But in terms of, I would say, and I don't think I've said that the Donald Trump presidency second term is better preferable to a Biden second term. Because I'll tell you, I don't know if I've made up my mind on that. I don't really know where I am on that, because as we've said, I'm concerned that the adults who were in the room in the first Trump term would not be there in a second. I think I made the point that there's an argument to be made, I think it's a good one, that if you're interested, as I am, in sort of the small R Republicanism, liberty, so forth, all that, there's still sort of a balance of power, separation of power piece that would be present in a Trump presidency, just because all the institutions of the world would be aligned against him, that you wouldn't have with a Biden presidency.
I'm curious what you mean by that, because a scenario I see is that you have a Supreme Court that's going to be probably more generally supportive of the sort of policy things Donald Trump will want to do. You'll most likely have a Senate that has a Republican majority, and there's the possibility sort of things are going to be a little closer in the House. So I would argue that it's much more likely to have those sort of checks and balances with a Biden presidency than a Trump presidency, certainly, especially on the court side. But so I guess I'm trying to understand. So
on the court side, I mean, and maybe I was thinking more non-governmental institutions.
Okay, gotcha.
Right. So if going back to Murthy versus Missouri, the White House emails, a Trump White House emails Facebook and says, hey, cut it out. Stop running this stuff. What if we told you we want this post taken down? Donald Trump is very upset about this. I think the response from Facebook would be a thumbs down emoji. I wouldn't say that, you know, what I think the actual response would be, because this is it's a family show, Mike. But I think if those demands that were made on big tech, right, that are on display in Murthy, were made from the Trump administration, the response would be, you know, well, go F yourself, right?
Let's keep in mind
that I don't think that would be the case if the Biden administration.
But let's keep in mind that in 2019, when Donald Trump was still president, there were multiple antitrust actions taken against big tech companies, right? There was a Google one, a Meta one, an Amazon one, yeah. I believe even another app. So it's not like this is some sort of just solely Democrat Biden sort of thing. I just wanted to point out on the tech thing, right? Because that's just what happened.
Yeah. But I mean, again, let's say Donald Trump Jr. leaves his laptop at a repair shop, and it turns out there's all sorts of unflattering things on it. and the Trump administration reaches out to a major newspaper outlet and says, look, don't run this. We think this is all fake Russian disinformation. Do you think big tech would suspend that newspaper's account? No, of course not.
Well,
and those are the concerns that I have is in the broader culture. It's not just that.
I would argue that's less of an issue than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago, because there isn't a culture anymore in this country when it comes to politics. There is the conservative ecosystem, so? And there is the folks who are inclined to be Trump folks, they're the New York Post, they're the Fox News sort of folks, and that's their culture, that's what they get. And so what the New York Times does or doesn't do won't even get on their radar practically. So I think that's old thinking. I think in a lot of ways in that.
If you think Trump went to Twitter, or
I don't know if you want to use X as Facebook. An example, because Elon Musk is a big fan.
Yeah, that gets complicated. Yeah.
Yeah.
But let's say went to Facebook and said, we want you to downgrade these posts from the New York Times. We think what the New York Times is running about Donald Trump paying hush money to this porn star is complete disinformation. It is most likely a Russian propaganda thing. Look, we've got some intelligence people who sign on to that. It's really irresponsible for you to even run that story, so you should just downgrade it. What do you think the New York Times would do?
I know how you want me to answer.
What do you think Facebook would do?
I know how you want me to. I understand that. I know how you want me to answer this. I'm not going to answer it that way, because I believe that they were mistaken in doing what they did. But I also believe, that based on the information, they acted based on the information they had. They acted based on what a lot of intelligence and former intelligence officials believed to be the case. And I do not believe that action, and this is where we'll disagree, was motivated primarily by partisan disdain or partisan bias. I understand that there is this enormous victim mindset on the right. And I believe that oftentimes that they are over-victimizing themselves, and that the world is not nearly as incredibly hostile, especially the world of big businesses, which their primary concern is always going to be profits. And it gets into this whole ESG thing. It gets into, and I think that I get it. Once you start seeing the world through the eyes of a victim, then it's really hard to see it any other way. And I think so many, even I would say reasonable Republicans like you have just so bought in to the, they're all out to get us, victim mindset, that it's hard for you to see the world any other way.
Again, I'm just asking the thought experiment.
Yeah, and that's why I said, that's why I disagree with you.
You don't think big tech, if it had been presented with the same information from the Trump administration, would have said, this story just isn't credible. We agree. We're going to downgrade it.
I believe if it were the same information with the same sort of support from a bipartisan group of former intelligence officials and national security folks, that they would have acted in a broadly similar way.
Recruited by the campaign, right?
I don't think it, you want me to answer the question. I'm answering the question. I'm saying that if everything were the same, aside from the administration asking for it, I think that the response would have been broadly the same.
Okay.
So there's your answer.
Do you think if the Trump administration had asked while it was in office, reached out to tech companies and said, listen, there is this crazy stuff going on alleging that I am a Russian mole, that I am in the pocket of Vladimir Putin. There's absolutely no evidence for that. We wish you would stop running this. But either he didn't or they didn't, but you understand my point. And I'll stand by it. And I think folks out there in the world, and like you and I can talk offline, I can provide you some other examples and we can figure out which ones we can put out publicly. I I think there was a big concern for me that Biden administration would empower a whole lot of other would have this sort of whole cultural buy-in, right? Across big tech, across big business, certainly through the media. And I think that to me is dangerous.
And I'll say
it's not saying yeah. Trump, and I'm not saying Trump is, and again, don't misunderstand. But if you're asking me what I see the dangers,
sure,
yeah. why I see one more dangerous than the other, that's why.
Yeah, I get that. I'll also say that it's also important to consider the messenger. And Donald Trump lies like hell. He has set up now through really decades of experience everyone has with him, the fact that he is an incredible liar. He is a disloyal, untrustworthy person in every aspect of his life. And so if somebody
terrible man,
if somebody with that sort of record comes to you and tells you something, it's going to be different than say, if I don't know, Mitt Romney came to you and said it, or somebody or Mike DeWine or somebody who has, you know, certainly is a person of the right, but has a reputation for not being just as incredible. And that matters. That should matter, mm-hmm. right?
So no, but let me evaluate that a little bit, because I know we're taking up more time, but I think this is an interesting discussion. Mitt Romney, you had the Senate president at the time stand up, Senate Majority Leader, I'm sorry, stand up at the time and say Mitt Romney has paid no taxes. It was an absolute lie. He admitted it later. It was an absolute lie, Harry Reid. But he said, yeah, but he's not president. The media swallowed that hook, line, and sinker. They ran with it. They did not say, like, hey, let's do an investigation to see if Mitt Romney did pay taxes. No, they took it hook, line, and sinker.
I don't believe that to be the case. I think that that is an incorrect statement. Now, we're in real time here, so I can't check it. But
okay.
I'm going to go on the record saying that I think that as I recall it, I believe that Senator Reid's remarks were reported, but the fact that remarks are reported is very different than saying that they are bought into hook, line, and sinker. And so,
All right. Well, if we can find the Snopes takedown saying Harry Reid, you know, whatever, false. Great. Let's find it. I don't think we will. Secondly, Joe Biden, again, you're saying Trump is a horrible, terrible person because he lies all the time. Joe Biden has spent the last 40 years talking about a man who he said drank his lunch that day and ran a stop sign and killed his wife. That's fundamentally untrue. And it has been shown untrue and again and again and again. The police reports show that he was not at fault in that accident. But Biden has said this for years and years and years, defaming this man so that he can, you know, claim this sort of victimhood. That troubles me. And that troubles me about Biden's character. Biden lies about stuff all the time.
So Biden would you say
lied about? Let me throw a couple more examples.
Yeah, go ahead.
Biden came on national TV, interrupted prime time, where he went on to accuse the special prosecutor of the report, saying, you know, he brought up my son's death. How dare he bring this up? When the transcript shows, no, that's not what happened at all. Biden bald-faced lied to everyone there. So, look, if you want to say Donald Trump is a liar, I'll agree with you, you know, up and down all day. Yes, absolutely. My point is, when Donald Trump lies, and this goes to the press, all these other institutions jump up and down saying, look, he's lying, which is the appropriate thing to do. When Joe Biden does it, they don't. It's silence. If Donald Trump were to try to silence media, there would be screaming bloody murder, as there should be. When Joe Biden does it, it's not so much of a problem.
Except, that's
my point, and that's the distinction I'm trying to make.
I hear what you're saying, but I don't think that's. I think that's inaccurate. I think that's inaccurate in part because I don't know that you have enough familiarity with the mainstream media to make that statement authoritatively. And secondly, I would again argue that that's not the case, because when Joe Biden says things that are untrue, there are major parts of the Fox News is an enormous news organization with incredible reach. There are a bunch of news organizations on the right that are enormous, that have incredible reach, and that stuff is reported on those organizations. Yeah. So that is heard. So
like the New York Post.
Yeah, like the New York Post. Exactly. Exactly. And so it's not like this stuff is buried. Yeah. Well, and not on X, because X, this stuff does get out on X, actually.
Well, I'm referring to former New York Post stories.
Sure. I get the obsession on the right with that. So yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But so, and anyway, the point being, and then getting back to the main point, we kind of got off on a side road here, is it sounds like, and you make a fair point in saying that it's not like Joe Biden is this man of perfectly impeccable character. He's not. But I think you will agree that while Joe Biden's character is nowhere close to perfect, if you weighed their character flaws on a scale, Donald Trump would be the fat kid on the teeter totter way down there, right? I mean, Donald Trump is a much worse person. Probably. Okay. Well, they're probably.
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, Joe Biden's sworn up and down. He's never talked to Hunter about business. He has nothing to do with Hunter's business. Well, doesn't look that way.
That's gonna be
a problem. And look, it depends on what you're talking about character, right? If Donald Trump wants to sleep with porn stars and pay them off, look, that's not commendable behavior. But does that trouble me as much as if the former vice president, presidential candidate, is receiving money from foreign corporations for what may seem to be official acts? That does trouble me much more. So that's when you're weighing those sort of things, if you're talking about personal.
Sure. Or for instance, if a sitting president is in some way using some backdoor channels to get the Saudi Arabian and other folks to stay at his hotels or use his services and raking in enormous profits, that would presumably trouble you as well.
It would.
Maybe even more if it's an actual in-office official, right?
Of course, the idea would be if someone's going to the hotel and paying for the hotel, they're getting the services of the hotel, and that's what they're paying for.
If they're paying, say, five times
what services the Biden family was providing.
Yeah, I'm saying if they're paying something like, you know, ultra above rates for doing.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. In that case. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. All right.
But I don't think there's any evidence to that.
Right? There's nothing that no one has proven. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. All right. Well, I think that pretty much covers it. So
second show on that.
Yeah, we certainly.
Again, let me just go back to my point. The story was going to be about the Ohio Senate race, but where did we end up?
Well, I think it was about here. Here's the thing: it was sort of going to be about the Ohio Senate race, but it needs to be about a lot more than that, because the vast majority of people listening to the podcast don't care about the Ohio Senate race as the Ohio Senate race. They care about the national and international implications of that race. Understandably so. Like if someone said to me, well, you know, there's the Iowa Senate race. Like, I guess. So I think that's the reason why. It's just a matter of not that, you know, certainly to Ohioans, it has a special resonance, but you know, I think that's part of the reason, the biggest part of the reason why, from my standpoint, certainly, is that, well, like listeners from California, New York, all those other places where most of our folks come from, that, hey, here's why this matters to you, or why it should, certainly. All right. Well, we will close there with this extra extended episode. We hope you appreciated it. If you're not already a supporter of the show, we hope you'll consider becoming one. It's what helps us keep going. And once you're a supporter, you know, I always feel like, Jay, I listen to the shows that Trey and Ken does, and Trey does this part way better than I do. I don't know. He's just kind of a natural at it. But anyway, I try. So you guys know the deal. You've probably been listening for a while. You get stuff, right? When you're a supporter, you get the ad-free version of the show. You get the full midweek show. You get to be on the Discord, and the Discord is a lot of fun. I probably spend way too much time on the Discord, but I really enjoy it anyway. So all that stuff, check it out. Just go to either patreon.com/politicsguys, or you can just look in the show notes. Probably the simpler thing to do. We always have links for all of our support stuff there. And As always, if you want to get that full midweek show, you're not in a position to support us financially, just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com. I'll get that set up for you. And as Trey mentioned last week, it really helps us out a lot if you can rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use. It's free, it's quick, it's easy. We would really appreciate it. So it'd be great if you could do that. And as always, we'll close with a very special thanks to our fantastic executive producers. They are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you'll join us.